Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 26, 2006. Today's session is entitled Foundation for Building Vital Communities, Moving from Needs to Assets, presented by Jody Kretzman. The number is KRJO2006-01. Let's listen in.
Good evening, everybody. I know some of you, but not all of you. My name is Jody Kretzman, and I'm a long-time Holden Village community member and teacher and learner, and I'm just delighted to be back here. We've been coming up for probably 30 years, and but I haven't been up for the last five or so, and so it's just delightful to be here again and be part of the Holden family and Holden conversation. I'm at Northwestern University in Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, where I direct an institute called the ABCD Institute, the Asset-Based Community Development Institute. And I want to talk a little bit about the kind of work that we've done from that base in the last years, and do a kind of background and introduction today, and then follow it up later in the week with a lot of specific stories and materials and tools and methods about people across the globe who are, in fact, learning how to build vital communities. A lot of what I think I know a little bit about comes from my hometown of Chicago, where we have lived for the last decades, and a lot of my time has been spent not on university campuses, but in communities in Chicago, across North America, and across the globe. And one of the things I've noticed constantly is that universities and communities are different places. Their whole way of being is different. Their way of knowing is different. People in universities often think that they know things when they've done surveys and studies about them and counted them up and made sure that they're scientifically validated. When you're in a community setting, nobody does studies or nobody does surveys. They mostly tell each other stories. And so I think most of what I want to do tonight and this week is to share a series of stories that we have picked up from communities across Chicago and across the globe, and try to weave them into a set of lessons about building strong communities. I want to say at the outset that I think an awful lot of what we've been developing with communities over the last few years has been really heavily influenced by Holden Village. And what Holden does to sort of self-consciously and proactively make community happen here, even though many of the people at Holden at any given time are passers-through, temporary folks, which makes the community building challenge even greater. But Holden clearly has been a huge, huge influence on us. So has Chicago. How many people here have some acquaintance with Chicago, at least a little bit? Okay, so one of the things you must know about is that most Chicago people love it and are completely chauvinistic about it and go around the country bragging about it all the time and talking about our world-class architecture and the 77 neighborhoods, which are absolutely fantastic places, all different from each other. We boast about the 21 miles of publicly accessible waterfront on Lake Michigan, which is the longest stretch of publicly accessible water in any city on the globe. We always brag about having the largest percentage of incarcerated public officials. John Marty was interested in learning that. I think concedes us the title. So it's a wonderful place, and it really has been for us a critical teacher over the years. In Chicago, those of us who are interested in community development, community building, stand on some incredible shoulders, people who have been doing the work before us. In the late 19th century, a woman named Jane Addams, how many people here know Jane Addams a little bit at least, right? Founded someplace called Hull House, the first settlement house in the United States, modeled after Toynbee Hall in London. And this wonderful daughter of a pastor from Rockford, Illinois, came into the middle of the teeming slums of Chicago, bought an old mansion, and decided that the way to build communities is to become a neighbor. to the people in the community. And so she moved in, became a neighbor, and got to know the people there and began developing around their agendas a community building kind of strategy. In Chicago also, the birth of modern community organizing was traced to a wonderfully irascible character named Saul Alinsky. How many people here have heard of Alinsky? A few at least. I may show a video about him sometime in the next 2 weeks. But he decided to combine the lessons that he had learned in the 1930s and 40s from the labor movement on the one hand and from the mafia on the other. He had studied both the labor movement and the mafia and decided that both of those things were settings in which you could learn a lot about power and how to exercise power and build power. So he took the lessons of the mafia and the labor movement and translated them into neighborhoods and said, even in lower income and working class neighborhoods, what we need is a strong voice. And you could bring people together at the local level and create what he called people's organizations, and those organizations could speak powerfully to outside forces like banks and city hall and people who wanted to rip up the neighborhood by building an expressway through it. And so he built sort of modern community organizing, and now an awful lot of the community organizing that goes on in the United States and in other countries is congregation-based. So a lot of the church, including the ELCA, has become committed to congregation-based community organizing in the Alinsky style. In the 1960s in Chicago, as Sarah Pitcher well knows, we were chosen as the northern city to which Dr. King would bring the civil rights movement. And so we've got that set of shoulders to stand on as well. And in the last three or four decades in Chicago, probably more strongly than any other city in the United States, the birth of what's called the CDC, the Community Development Corporation, has just burgeoned. And we now have about 110 of those in the city of Chicago, organizations that take neighborhood folks and try to rebuild economy and housing from the bottom up and from the inside out. So all of those are strategies and approaches that have been vital to influencing what we do at the ABCD Asset-Based Community Development Institute. Let me give you then a little bit of background about our particular work. In the 1980s, we were generously funded to basically leave town for about 3.5 years and travel across the United States to most of the 25 largest cities, to most, or at least a good number of Native peoples' reservations, and to a lot of rural communities and small towns. The places that we visited over a 3.5 year period had one thing in common, and that is that they were all struggling. They were all the most challenged community. They were all the places where the economic rug had been pulled out from under people, where people were trying to make something happen with not very many resources. So we spent a lot of time in places like the South Bronx in New York City. We just had in the last week one of the places we spent a lot of time in Miami, Liberty City, Watson, Los Angeles, east side of Detroit. Lots of public housing all over the place, including in San Francisco. Lots of struggling Native people's reservations, lots of Appalachian towns where the coal mining had gone under. And so we visited these places over and over and over again for a 3.5 year period and have stayed in touch with most of them ever since. And sometimes when I recite that itinerary, 3.5 years of going from one challenged community to another, people look at me with a great deal of sympathy and say, that must have been incredibly depressing. How could you even think about getting up every day if your next visit is to someplace else that's really hard up against it? And what I want to report here at the beginning is that, in fact, it was a journey that was exactly the opposite. It was an exhilarating, hope-filled set of encounters that lasted for these 3.5 years and have lasted ever since for us. And the reason I think it was hope-filled and creative was that we had decided to ask a different kind of question when we entered a community. We were not going to ask the question, as so many of these communities were used to hearing when somebody came in from the outside, tell us about what's wrong here. Tell us about the dropout rate and the crime rate and all of the illiterates here and all of the drugs and all of the gang. Instead, we assumed that and asked the alternative question. What in the face of all these challenges is happening that's succeeding? what's creating hope? And so we ended up collecting over 3,000 what we started calling hope stories. And eventually, we looked back at what we had collected, these hope stories, places where people were taking the parks back from the gangbangers and the drug dealers, places where people were giving kids who were in gang experiences the opportunity to do something positive and become a carpentry co-op, places where businesses were being revived, where micro-businesses were being started, where some kind of effort to turn the schools around was beginning to succeed. And we collected these stories, looked back over them, picked about our favorite 250, and put them in a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out, and tried to frame the book in the people's own language, the language that they had told us the stories in, so it's not an academic book, and tried to frame the book in a way that the lessons that we were learning became clear and evident to people who would be interested in building stronger communities. So that was the sort of start of this effort, at least in its last chapter. Since Building Communities from the Inside Out, we've done a series of about 18 other publications and workbooks, which I might be treating later on in the week a little bit, one called Asset-Based Strategies for Faith Communities, how to take some of this community wisdom and apply it within a congregational setting and connect the congregation back to the community. So I want to talk a little bit about the lessons that came out of that odyssey collecting hope stories. Let me take a little brief detour here near the beginning and say that one of the things that happened to us as we were collecting stories from the late 20th and early 21st century of community building is that we got steered back into ancient wisdom, often biblical wisdom, about community building, and started finding all of the places in the Bible where both in Old Testament and New Testament settings, people are trying to build community. The lessons there are legion. We also got steered into other faith traditions, and I want to tell you a very brief story that comes out of a tradition which is not our own Judeo-Christian tradition, but which is the Muslim tradition. And it's one of my favorite stories about building strong communities. It's from the Sufi Muslim tradition. People here know Sufi stories at all, right? They're the sort of mystical end of the Muslim faith, and they tell stories that are just wonderful and filled with all kinds of wisdom, the way the culture gets passed on. And here's one of my favorites. Those of you who know Sufi stories know that fairly often they differ from our own in that they start with the moral. The moral's right up front, and then the story sort of unfolds what the moral says. The moral of the Sufi story I want to tell you briefly is this. You will only learn what you already know. You got it? You will only learn what you already know. Those of us who are teachers have a sort of humbling moment when we hear this piece of wisdom. The story goes like this. There was a village in deep trouble. The kids were misbehaving, the jobs were disappearing, all of the income indicators were going down, crime was going up, and the village was in terrible shape, getting worse, and the elders of the village began to meet and tried to decide what to do about it. And after meeting a number of times to try to strategize about how to bring the village back into a more vital and healthy equilibrium, one of the elders said one night, "I have heard that there's an incredibly wise person in another village that really knows how to rebuild communities and villages. And what we ought to do is to invite this wise person in to help us decide what to do." And so they issued an invitation, and in time, the wise woman came to the village. And when she appeared in the village, she gathered the villagers in front of her, and she asked them a question. And she said, her question was, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And in unison, the villagers looked at her and said, "No, we have no idea what you're going to tell us. We wouldn't have asked you here if we knew." And so the wise woman said, "In my long experience, I have learned that you will only learn what you already know. And if you don't know what I'm going to tell you, I have nothing to tell you." And she left. A very short technical assistance visit. And the villagers were a little confused, even a little miffed about this treatment. And they met again and decided that since this woman had such a wonderful reputation, they ought to try again and have her back. And so they invited her back a second time. And again, the wise woman came and gathered the villagers and asked her question, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time the villagers, they understood that they were hearing a trick question now. And so in unison, they answered, "Yes." And the wise woman looked out and said, "Well, if you already know, then I have nothing left to tell you." She left. And the villagers were even more miffed and met some more and decided this woman really does somehow have a great reputation. What's the problem here? And so they invited her back a third time. She came back the third time. She gathered the villagers, asked her question, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time, they were so well organized that in unison, half of the villagers shouted, "Yes," and half of the villagers shouted, "No." So the wise woman looked out and she said, "Now, well, everybody who knows what I'm going to tell you, tell everybody who doesn't know." And that way she said, "We'll all know." And she left, and she never came back again. And that night, a leader in the village had a dream, which she reported out to the gathered villagers the next morning. And she said, "I had a dream last night in which a voice appeared to me and told me the meaning of the message from the wise woman." She said, "The wise woman really wants us to know that every important piece of wisdom and knowledge is already here in our village and not in some outside experts. We already know. We have our culture, we have our history, and most importantly, we have our relationships with each other." She said, "The wise woman wanted us to focus on what we know and what we have, not on what we don't know and what we don't have." She said, "The only thing we don't have is the confidence to believe that we have the knowledge," right? The confidence to believe that we have the knowledge. As we traveled across the United States in the last decades, working with, meeting with community people at the grassroots level who are actually doing productive, successful, effective community building work, we're now convinced that that Sufi story is as applicable in 21st century America as it was 7 centuries ago in the Middle East, that where people have rediscovered the power of local experience, local knowledge, local culture, and local relationships, there astonishing things can happen. So let me try to clarify in another way the major lesson of our treks here. For me, it came alive most clearly on a really hot summer morning. I'm reminded of it a little bit today, when I was many years ago in a place called the South Bronx in New York City. And we had visited the South Bronx frequently and had found wonderful people in the South Bronx in the 80s who were successfully, in really tough circumstances, building stronger neighborhoods and communities. Some of you are old enough maybe to remember when the South Bronx in the 70s and 80s was the ultimate symbol of urban despair. If it was broken any place, it was broken worse in the South Bronx. It was a place that had lost 120,000 jobs over a 15-year period, the kinds of jobs that people could get without even a high school diploma and make a living, make a hopeful living, buy a house, have something better for their kids and grandkids. Those jobs were gone. South Bronx was a place that had changed racially and was experiencing the isolation now that it was majority African-American and Latino that sometimes happens to communities of color. South Bronx is a place where every major institution was basically broken, where the schools seemed to make kids dumber rather than smarter. The criminal justice system was terrific at producing criminals and not justice. There were a huge number of systems that ought to have been functioning that simply weren't. So it was a tough place. But my major host for many years in the South Bronx was a wonderful woman whose name I try to keep alive because although she died 7 years ago, she was so incredibly important to me. Her name was Mrs. Edna Johnson. She was an African-American woman who died at the age of 84, 7 years ago, who had spent the last 50 years of her life in the South Bronx trying in really tough circumstances to make hope stories happen. And she had been our guide to hope stories in the South Bronx. And on this particular occasion, she had led me to another one, it was the second incarnation in the United States of what has now been a really successful federal program for the last couple of decades called Youth Build. Anybody know about Youth Build? It's the program that takes kids out of gang situations and gives them some skills in terms of carpentry and rehabilitating buildings and apartments, and then puts them into groups to do really productive work in neighborhoods. And it's just a stunning program. Mrs. Johnson had found the first chapter of that in Harlem, just south of the South Bronx, and brought it up in typical fashion in her way of operating into the South Bronx. And we had just spent the morning with 15 of these kids who had been pretty tough gangbangers and into the drug dealing in the South Bronx. And this was their about 6 month anniversary of being part of Youth Build and being part of this cooperative build and rebuilding all of the housing that had been burned down in arson for profit schemes in the South Bronx. And so we had spent the morning with these kids, and they were just incredible kids, so excited, so committed, so grateful to be having the opportunity to contribute to the community. And they were telling us their personal stories and their group stories about doing that. And I was really moved and touched by their stories. We came back to Mrs. Johnson's front porch and sat talking about that for a while, about the kids that we had just met, what they represented in terms of what could be learned about how to turn neighborhoods around. And there was a pause in the conversation, and I asked her then a question that I'd never asked her before. I said, you know, these are just wonderful stories that you're showing me about young people, alternatives to gangs, and economic opportunity being built here. But I said, it's still the South Bronx, right? It's still a really tough place. What do you think happened here, Mrs. Johnson? Why did this happen? And she was quiet for about 40 seconds, at least, maybe a whole minute. And I think what she was doing was scrolling through in her mind all of the correct answers to my question, why did that happen? And it could have been, she could have said, it's the 120,000 jobs that we don't have anymore. Or she could have said, it's the isolation from social, community, economic centers that comes out of racism. She could have said that. She could have talked about the broken institutions. But she didn't say any of those things. Instead, she said, Jody, when I think about it, probably the worst thing that ever happened to us in my community is that we got put into a prison. And I was pretty baffled. I said, I don't understand it. We're sitting on your front porch, and there's a streetscape in front of us with some empty lots and some burned out buildings and then some new buildings, but it doesn't look like there's barbed wire or prison guards or high walls. What do you mean you've been put into a prison? And she said back to me, no, I don't mean that kind of literal prison, although I think, and this was many years ago, she said, I think we have enough of those, we don't need to build anymore, and there was a piece of policy advice we've not followed. And she said, no, the prison I'm talking about is a prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. Prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. You hear that? Does that make some sense? I said, that sounds important. Could you say some more and tell me a little bit more about what you mean? And she said, okay, well, let me just tell you, Jody, what happens to me every week. At least once a week, because I'm involved in so many things in my neighborhood, I have to go down to City Hall in Lower Manhattan. Or I have to go out to the suburbs at some churches or some funders to try to get support for what I'm doing in my community. And she said, almost every time what happens to me is I walk into a room and I introduce myself and I say, hi, Mrs. Edna Johnson. And I want to talk to you about my neighborhood, some of the things happening in my neighborhood. And she said, they're always nice people, and they always say, hi, Mrs. Johnson. Love to talk to you. What neighborhood is that? And she says, I try to say it with a lilt in my voice. I'm from the South Bronx. And she said, the lilt never works. She said, it happens all the time. The minute I say the word South Bronx, I can see what happens to people's heads. They just fill up with all kinds of ideas and images about my neighborhood. None of the people I'm talking to, she said, has ever been in my neighborhood, but they think they know what it is. And so she was one of the, you can imagine, right, some of the ideas and images she's talking about. Shout some out.
Dangerous.
Yep.
Messy.
Littered.
Yep. Maybe even more than that. She was one of the ones that taught us to sort of think about this kind of simple imagery. This is a neighborhood needs map. You guys want to go where you can see it a little bit? This is not a map of a particular piece of geography. It's a map of the mind. And this was what Mrs. Johnson said, almost automatically dropped into people's heads the minute she said the word South Bronx. Right? Oh, I know about that place. That's a place that's characterized by crime and welfare, child abuse, broken families, unemployment, gangs. And what she was saying was that this needs map constitutes for her and her neighbors a prison. You see how that might be? Now, the problem with this map is not that it's a false map. This is a true map. This is a true map of a lot of neighborhoods we work in Chicago. Certainly was a true map about South Bronx. But the problem is, it's not the whole truth, right? And it's taken as if it is the whole truth. Am I being clear here? Right? She was one of the people also, Mrs. Johnson, who taught us never to go any place without this. And you sort of see what this is. This is the hackneyed, cliched symbol, the half-full, half-empty glass, right? What I want to remind you of briefly is something you already know, which is that this glass, half full and half empty, is exactly like every one of us, right? And it's exactly like every community. For every one of us, we all have some fullness, some skills and gifts, capacities and histories, and knowledge, and wisdom, creativity, right? Holden attracts people like that. But as far as I know, there's no test at Holden that says that only people who are completely full are welcome here. And so it's true, I think, that every one of us also has some emptiness, some challenges and some difficulties, some needs and some problems. Is that true? We're a confessional church, aren't we? I sometimes invite people, if you really want to meet deficient, empty, needy, problematic people, people you just want to shake your head and extend pity to, you really ought to spend time on any university campus and get to know the faculty. At least it's true at my place, at Northwestern. I'm sure it's not true at campuses out this direction. But at Northwestern, we're a policy institute that's interdisciplinary, has 24 people from 8 different departments. And when we get around the table together, it's just a sorry mess. We look at each other and shake our heads, and there are people who just can't keep a marriage together. One guy is trying for the 5th time. He's going to do it until he gets it right. People whose kids don't speak to them. People with all kinds of health challenges, two are battling cancer at this point. People who drink too much. People who can't balance their checkbooks, or it's constantly teetering on the brink of debt. They seem to be more often than not the economists for some reason. They're just a mess. But what I'm reminded of constantly is that we at Northwestern, like I think everybody else in the room, are part of a vast conspiracy, which is global in nature. And we conspire on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis as much as possible to ignore each other's emptiness and instead to concentrate on the fact that these same messed up people are wonderful teachers, they're good writers, they can frame a research topic, they actually like people called students. They can do what's necessary to make a good university run. I don't know about you, but I think it's been my experience that any organization that I've ever been affiliated with that works on the same principle, right? Let's take screwed up people and figure out what they can do. Where are their gifts? Where are their talents? Where are their skills? And how can we build a structure of opportunities for them to contribute? And what Mrs. Johnson was saying was that for decades, she had been told in her community that the important part of their glass was the empty part. Who told her that? Well, universities tell them that. We won't write about you except as urban problems, right? Or urban issues. The mass media tell Mrs. Johnson and her neighbors that. We have a journalism school at Northwestern in Mobile. And the cynical advice given to young journalists who are about to cover inner city communities for the first time is, if it bleeds, it leads, right? We're interested what the lead stories are, the gangbang, the drive-by shootings, the drug wars, right? That's the lead story. How many here have ever written a grant proposal of any kind for funding to the government or the Gates Foundation? What's the first page that you write? That's the Problem statement, a needs survey, a needs assessment. In other words, the challenge is for people with resources on the outside, get better and better at telling us about your emptiness, and we'll give you resources and help and experts and programs from the outside. And that's the dance that my friend Mrs. Johnson was describing as a prison-making dance. Does that make sense? And it's the only game in a lot of neighborhoods, and it has just devastating consequences. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but here are a few of them. If I get told in my neighborhood and community more often, this is the same thing true on Native people's reservations, that I'm characterized mostly by my needs and problems and deficiencies, sometimes, thank goodness not all the time, I start to believe it and I internalize the idea that I can't possibly know enough to raise my kids. I don't possibly have the skills to enter the job market. I can't possibly go with my neighbors and make my block safe. And if I don't think there are any resources in my neighborhood, why would I ever turn to local relationships? All the answers are out there. None of them are on my block. None of them are in my congregation, with my pastor, or with my extended kin. And when we don't use our local relationships, they atrophy and die. Funds come into the neighborhood in narrow categorical flows, and they go toward professional helpers and not residents. They've created, ironically, a new kind of leader in lots of communities. When I was starting out as a community organizer many decades ago, I trained with this guy called Saul Alinsky for a little bit. And Alinsky used to say, the first thing you do when you go into a new neighborhood is you find the natural leaders. He says, every neighborhood has natural leaders. Find them. And people would say, well, what is a leader, Saul? And Saul would say, a leader is somebody with followers who can get something done. that was his definition. Now we have leaders, not necessarily who are people who can get something done with followers, but whose major characteristic as a leader is speaking, raising funds, speaking to outside forces about how bad things are here. So in fact, leadership becomes the capacity to denigrate your neighbors, not to lead them to get something done. It's a very, very different kind of leadership. And of course, that's a pattern that rewards failure. You get more money if you've got more pregnant teens this year than you did last year, and creates a kind of cycle of hopelessness. Well, if even part of that resonates with you as being plausible or true, the wonderful news is that in now hundreds and hundreds of communities across the United States and on six continents, people have decided that Mrs. Johnson's right and that a sole focus on the empty part of the glass is a dead end and leads to a hopeless ending. And they have gotten very serious about constructing their own map, a map of the fullness, a community assets map. What do you see in a community if you get serious about mapping, understanding all of the resources that are here? Let me use a different kind of list. One of the things that really surprised my colleague John McKnight and I when we went around collecting these hope stories and talking with the people in communities that had made them happen, when they started telling us how they did it, we kept hearing over and over again that they used some local resources to do it. And so we now think that there is not a community in the United States, or we're beginning now to be more confident about saying anywhere, that doesn't have some unique combination of these five kinds of assets in a community. This is not rocket science, but it's an attempt to take this sort of mushy word community and say, what are its elements? What make up a community? First of all, most obviously, it's the talents and skills of the people who live there. Let's not think about public housing residents as simply destitute single moms. Let's think about them, and this is something we've discovered over and over again working with friends in public housing. Let's think about them as the largest concentration of skilled plumbers in the United States. It's true. If you want to find the largest concentration of skilled plumbers in the U.S., go to public housing. Because nobody in public housing is under any illusion that the housing authority will ever fix their plumbing. And so they all know how to fix showers and toilets and sinks. And they know lots of other things as well. Secondly, let's think about, in a community context, all of the networks of relationships that make up that community, all of the local associations, all of the groups. Associations is a word that was coined in the English language by Alexis de Tocqueville, 1831, and it was what he thought characterized American democracy. That people who were not elected or didn't have a title handed down to them, any Tom, Dick, and Mary would come together, form a group, and decide, we're going to pave the sidewalk. We're going to build the streets. We're going to build the school. We're going to build the church. In my own experience as a community organizer, probably my most important lesson was I was never going to get anything done in the community on the west side of Chicago where I was working if I didn't constantly talk with the four women who walked around the community every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. They didn't have a name for their group, but they were the people who were looking at what was going on, what were the challenges here, what ought to be done, what are people thinking about, they were the heart and soul and ears and eyes of the community. So these local associations and networks of relationships are critical. One of the most important functions of churches in communities is that they both represent these networks of relationships and they spawn them. They are soil out of which these networks and relationships are born and grow. We'll come back to that later in the week. Third, every community is made up of institutions and professional entities. The distinction between the second and third categories here is associations are places where most of the work gets done by people who don't get paid. The members do the work. And institutions are places where paid people do the work. And we think now, in our experience, that there's a huge difference between the two. So we're talking about institutions, public ones, like libraries and parks and schools, police. We're talking about nonprofits, all of the agencies, and human service places, health places. And we're talking about private businesses. Obviously, those are critical assets in every community. Fourth, and obviously, whether we're talking about rural communities or urban communities, there are physical assets, the land and property and buildings, equipment, the infrastructure, the transportation has to be part of the understanding of the assets of the community. And fifth and finally, every community, no matter how destitute, has an economy going there. People produce things. People consume things. There are business assets. There's an awful lot of barter going on. So in brief and in summary, we now think that community building that is successful and sustainable is a three-step process. Number one, find these assets, lift them up, get proactive about it, celebrate them, make sure that people in the community don't think about themselves as primarily empty, but think about themselves as having some fullness and resources. Secondly, connect the assets. Make sure that the skills of the young people, when they're discovered, get connected with local networks and associations and then maybe funneled into economic productivity. Constantly connect. And third, find the assets, connect the assets, and in lots of communities where we're doing work, harness them to a hopeful vision of the future. Where do we want this place to be in 10 or 15 years, and how do we use what we've got to get there? So that's what we think community development that's successful and sustainable looks like. Find assets, connect assets, harness them to a vision. Does that make sense?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
What would you define as the smallest group of people that you would use as community for this kind of thing?
Yeah, there's a, let me say two things about that that you make me think of. One is a critically important thing to think about the scale here. Because obviously some things here, particularly the gathering of the talents and skills of the individual residents, need to happen on a pretty small scale. On a couple of blocks, on a smaller neighborhood of maybe 500-600 people, within a congregation, the congregation's neighbors, and then the individual sort of smaller neighborhoods working together, whole cities or municipalities, whole communities. There are, we think, strategies that are appropriate to each of those levels. And then, you know, moving up into the larger context of regional and state and federal. So I think the vague answer I want to leave you with at this point is the scale question is absolutely critical. You could do different things with these assets at different levels of the scale question. And paying attention to scale is crucial. We're much more interested in making sure that the smaller scale definitions of community remain at least on the radar screen so that people don't immediately go to the state, to the federal government, but have something happening at the grassroots kind of level. The other kind of quick question is, I recognize, and we should all recognize, that there are lots of different kinds of communities. We happen to be focused mostly here on geographically defined communities, but we all, each one of us in the room, you know, belongs to all kinds of different communities, faith communities, or ethnic and cultural communities, or language communities, or communities of interest, right? And all of those are important. Some of what I think we know about the process at the geographic level also spills over into other kinds of communities as well. But that's a whole other topic, too. But yes?
Have you been able to impact funding sources that will ask you to do asset mapping?
Yeah.
Such.
We've worked a lot with funding sources. Our last publication was with the Kellogg Foundation, and it's on their website as well as ours. Now, when they asked us to put together some kind of a set of tools for all of their grantees, they're the third largest foundation in the country at this point, that would allow their grantees to take a look at, no matter what they were particularly doing, a youth program, an economic development program, a rural development program, a health program, no matter what they were doing as a sort of focus, were they doing it in a way that connected all the other assets in the community? So that's an example. I think the way we tend to talk with our friends in the funding community is to say, your critical challenge is you've been working this way, a charity model forever. You've been asking communities to hold their hands out, tell you about their needs and their problems and deficiencies, and then you're going to pour programs and resources and experts into that. And we think that a much more effective way to think about the relationship between funding resources and communities is as an investment model. You need to know what assets are there as a funder to invest in them to get a return, right? So that you can pull out after a while and communities can sustain what they've got. Let me conclude with a couple of quick examples just to drive the
point. Yeah, Bob? One more thing, Julia. When you had that needs map up there, that needs map is true of smaller communities as well.
Absolutely.
And when you went around those 25 places or so, is it a matter of scale? Is the proportion of problems higher in those places? Or is it that smaller communities of 50 or 100,000 have a better chance of handling that on a smaller scale than the South Bronx does?
Well, it could be that it's easier to get your head around the whole community in Duluth than it is in New York City. On the other hand, I don't think there's a community of any size, or for that matter, any wealth, that doesn't have both parts of the glass. No matter if you're talking about a very upper income, leafy suburb on the North Shore of Chicago, that community has some obvious fullness and maybe some less obvious emptiness. And so it's always a question of how do you find and mobilize what you've got to begin to attack what the problems are emptiness is. And I think to some degree it's probably easier to figure out how to do that on a scale of Duluth than it is the South Bronx. Let me just conclude here with a couple quick examples. These are concrete, real examples. They're just two ways of thinking about a human being, right? The first I want to show you is an example from a state welfare department. And this is the instructions. It's an actual survey form that we put on the overheads here. To a welfare worker, and this is what the state says the welfare worker needs to know after the first 20-minute interview with a person who's making that incredibly difficult journey from welfare to work. Well, every state now has welfare to work requirements, and here's what one state says you need to know. Tell me about your inadequate housing, your limited job-seeking skills, the poor work history you have, how often you've been fired from jobs, you don't have any recent work history. Tell me about your rate of absenteeism, the diploma or GED you don't have, the training for your career goals that you don't have. Here's maybe a neutral question, how old are you? But then it gets back, are you a pregnant or parenting teen? Are you a single parent? You don't have any child care available. You've got skills, but unfortunately they're not in demand. You don't have transportation. You don't have driver's license or insurance. Tell me about your sick dependents. Goes on. You don't have the necessary license or credentials. You don't communicate very well, do you? You're uncertain about your employment goals. They're unrealistic. You don't have the right clothes. Tell me about your family problems that could prevent your training. It goes on. Tell me about your bad eyes, your bad ears, and your bad teeth, and other medical problems that could prevent your training and employment, and financial problems. Tell me about your friends and family. They won't be very supportive of this, will they? How about your history of mental illness, your history of drug or alcohol abuse, your felony record, how often you've lost your benefits. So there you have it. Now we know everything we need to know about this person, don't we? The last note, which I lost here, says at the end of the interview, now tell us anything else that you think would be helpful in setting your employment goals. Any reactions to this?
It sounds like victim language.
Absolutely, completely. It's, in a sense, it's a map to that person's emptiness alone, right? And it's a map that says, basically, you're a worthless human being, right? And for lots of people, if I'm a single mother of three kids in an inner city neighborhood, this may be about the 14th time in my life since kindergarten that somebody in an authoritative position, institutional power over me, has held up a mirror that sends that message. You can't read very well, you're not great at the school, you don't do this. And, we're pretty clear now that this happens not just to welfare recipients, but since people know we collect these kinds of things, we've got stacks of them. And they apply not only to welfare, it happens to kids. Inevitably, the first encounter that a young person has when they get in trouble with the youth juvenile courts is an interview like this. How many times have you contemplated suicide? Tell me about your gang affiliation. How often do you do drugs? How many times were you beaten? Just a whole range of questions about a person's emptiness. I think we tend to do it to older folks, too, the minute we start needing a little help to get around or thinking about assisted living or something, somebody barrages us with questions about what doesn't work anymore. What can't you do? Tell me about how bad your memory has gotten. All the stuff that we can't do. We've got another stack from the Immigration Department asking people coming into the country about all the terrible stuff that they were involved with in their own country. So in a sense, we think this is one of the major ways in which communities marginalize members. They regard them as if the primary reality about the person was their emptiness. They are an object to be fixed, to be helped at best, but they're certainly not somebody who's got any fullness to contribute, right? So that's one way. Here's, I'll finish with an alternative. And one of the happy things about our life is that the stack of the alternatives are now higher than the stacks of the examples of focusing on the emptiness. Here's one of my favorite, what some people call capacity inventory. So communities are inventing ways of having conversations about the full part of the glass. And this one comes from the largest Baptist church in Cincinnati, Ohio, New Prospect Baptist Church, downtown Cincinnati, pastored by a wonderful colleague and friend of ours named Reverend Damon Lynch. Damon is a genius community builder, and he's gotten his folks to be that as well. New Prospect Baptist still runs, the largest soup kitchen in Cincinnati. They were feeding over 300 people a night, and what happened some years ago was that all of a sudden, the leaders of the congregation, and Damon too, Reverend Lynch, got frustrated with the ministry. And what was frustrating was the same people keep coming back. Why can't we be more effective in making some change in their lives? Why can't we make the soup kitchen unnecessary? And they asked themselves the question, well, why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we making a difference in people's lives? And their answer was interesting. They said, you can't make a difference in people's lives if you don't know them, if you don't have a relationship with them. And we don't with many of these people. And then they said, no, wait a minute. Not entirely true. They said, we do know a lot about the people we feed in terms of their emptiness. We know many of them are homeless, and others are estranged from their family, and some are jobless, and some of them drink and have drug problems, but we don't know much about the fullness. And so they constructed what I think is a wonderfully eloquent and respectful one-page questionnaire. Talk to people about the fullness, and I'll just show it to you briefly here. Say, hi, what's your name? Thank you for coming over. Did somebody talk to you about what the gift exchange is all about? That's what they called their set of conversations. So they're doing one-on-one conversations with 300-plus people in the soup kitchen about the gift exchange. And they start by assuming that the person they're talking to has something that they think the gift exchange might be. What do you think it's, what do you understand it to be? And then basically they say, we believe that everybody has God-given talents and gifts that can be used to benefit the community. I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about your gifts and skills. Then they say, before we get started, let me give you a small gift. Let me really briefly describe what happened here. They had the kids in the congregation spend about 4 weekends making small gift boxes, brightly wrapped and be-ribboned, and making the gift inside. And the gift inside was a keychain. So beginning of the interview, the person opens up the box. There's a keychain there, and the keychain has a wonderful piece of community-building wisdom on it that I find very thought-provoking. They open it up, and the piece calligraphied on the keychain is, your gift is your key to your community. Your gift is your key to your community. So they sort of talk about that for a couple of minutes and noodle about what that might mean. Then they say, I want to ask you about 3 things, but I want to talk to you, gifts and skills and dreams. So here are folks who are saying, just as people in the community taught us, that if you're thinking about the full part of a community, it's made up of these 5 elements of assets. Here's somebody positing the idea that if we're talking about the full part of a human being, we could say that it's made up of gifts and skills and dreams. And if you knew about gifts and skills and dreams, you'd know a lot about the full part of that person. I love the way some of the questions are phrased. Gifts are abilities we're born with. We can develop them, but nobody has to teach them. What positive qualities do people say you have? So you don't have to be boastful and brag and say I'm a terrific this or that. Somebody once said about me that I was a good listener. Who are the people in your life that you give to? How do you give to them? When was the last time you shared with somebody else? What was it? What do you give that makes you feel good? They got some answers about when was the last time you shared it. Brown paper bag, wine bottle last night, and that was perfectly okay. Skills, what do you do best? What do you enjoy doing? If you could start a business, what would it be? What do you like to do that people would pay you to do? I love that question. That's the ultimate vocational question. What do you love to do that people would pay you to do? Ever made anything? Ever fixed anything? And then dreams. What are your dreams? If you could snap your fingers and be doing anything, what would it be? And these were not people who had been asked about their dreams very frequently. That's the first time for lots of them. I want to thank you. We're talking to as many people as we can. We're going to do 2 things here. One is begin a wall of fame here in the soup kitchen, and the other is try to figure out how to use these gifts in building the community. So let me end by telling you what I saw when I visited the soup kitchen about 6 months after this process started, and they had talked to about 240 people, right? I walk in. I'd been there 3 or 4 times before, so I knew a bunch of people, but this time it was different. I walk in, it's a huge room, probably 6 times bigger than this, and the walls had been whitewashed cinder block, right? But they were no longer white. Now they were splashed with primary colors. And inside, huge geometric shapes, triangles and rectangles and circles, inside each of these geometric shapes was a person. A person's name, a big blown up Polaroid, or caricature sketch. They got some of the kids who really went wonderful drawings, and the person's gifts and skills and dreams. And what they had found was some astonishing stuff. In the first 200 and some interviews they did, they found over 40 people with carpentry skills, claimed they knew how to do various carpentry things. And what I learned was that just the previous month, about 15 of those folks who had been meeting for a number of months had officially formed themselves into a carpentry cooperative. And we're beginning now the work of rehabilitating some of the fallen down, burned out buildings in Over the Rhine neighborhood, downtown Cincinnati. They found over 70 people with music skills, play an instrument, sing. And that explained why in one corner of this huge room there was a 5-piece jazz combo playing, made up of people who had discovered each other through this process. I always say it was not the best jazz combo I've ever heard in my life. They were spirited. In another corner, taking advantage of the fact that an awful lot of people said, I've got a lot of experience caring for kids. There was after some vetting, they had put together a kids' corner, and there was a whole kids' activity center with adults and young people reading to each other and playing games and having a wonderful time. So that the walls had begun to become alive in the soup kitchen in really astonishing ways. And as I looked around, something began sort of creeping into my head that was a baffling experience. I didn't quite know what it was that I was seeing, and I had to ask some questions about what I thought I was seeing, and so here's what I discovered. I discovered that when the question about skills had been asked, what do you do best, what do you like to do best, that in these interviews, one skill got mentioned far more frequently than any other skill. Just over the top, the most often mentioned skill began being really evident to the people who were doing the interviews. Any ideas about what it is? Oh, you might know the story already.
Cooking.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. It was cooking in a soup kitchen. Cooking in a soup kitchen. And after a while, the church folks pondered what they were hearing, and they recognized that they were not just hearing about it. A skill called cooking. They were hearing from people who were saying to them, you know, I don't want to be on this side of the table anymore. With you on the other side of the table, cooking for me and serving me. Because as long as I'm over here and you're over there, you are a fully valued member of this community, and I'm nothing. They were saying, I want to come around on the cooking side, and I want to be a fully valued member of this community too. So after they heard this is church people who were both wise and courageous decided they had to act on it. And they acted on it in two ways. The first way they acted on it was they changed the rules for the volunteers. They said, we still need dozens of volunteers from our church and from other churches. Keep coming. Big operation. We need you. But from here on in, the rules change. If you're going to volunteer, come hungry. Nobody just serves and cooks. Everybody eats. We're an eating community. And they got a little pushback from that. Some of the folks, you know, we're going to eat with those people. But most of them, after a little bit, adjusted to it. And it became an eating community. And they thought, now how do we change things for the people coming in for a meal? We can't just change the rules. We'll probably get real resistance there. And so they did a very smart community building thing. They went back over their notes, found the 20 most enthusiastic would-be cooks, the people who had just jumped out of their chairs saying, I love to cook. I cook a mean pot of chili. And they went back to those 20 people one-on-one and said, we really do need you in the kitchen. Come and join us. Would you be part of the kitchen team? We'll give you a little orientation, and please come and join us. What they reported to me, the church folks, is that of the first 20 people they asked, 19 jumped on it. And within two nights, they were back in the kitchen. And now many of them were coming back multiple nights a week to help out in the kitchen. And then what happened, much more quickly than any of the church people had expected, was that other folks coming in for a meal and standing in line began seeing their friends and colleagues back in the kitchen. And they began asking, can we come back there too? Do you need some more help in the kitchen? Or if you're full in the kitchen, is there something else I can do? Do you need help serving? Or could I help clean up a little bit? Or things with the walls that you could use? Or how about some music or some childcare during dinner hour? And so, this was the explanation for what I had seen, which baffled me. What baffled me was that it was the first soup kitchen I had ever been in my life where I looked around, 250 people in the room, all kinds of things going on, and I couldn't tell who was who. I couldn't tell who were the volunteers from the church and who were the people who came in for a meal. You see what that means? For me, it's become a really powerful microcosm of what a healthy community is. A healthy and vital community is one in which nobody is regarded primarily as empty, needy, and problematic, pushed to the side, thought of somebody that as somebody that needs help, needs fixing. Everybody is recognized as gifted, and everybody's going to give their gifts. Nobody's going to escape, right? I think in another sense, what the church people had recognized was the ironic truth that in almost every situation, people who help or serve have power over people that they're helping and serving, right? There's a power difference there that's really significant, and they were working to eliminate that. I don't think they got there entirely, but they were closer to this. They were closer to a two-way street, to an exchange, right? They were closer. And so one of the wonderful things that happened on this particular visit was I got into a long conversation with a bunch of the church leaders about what this language is. We know about this. This is about serving and helping and servies and helpies. And, that's a dangerous language. It's about professionals and clients. It's about all the hierarchical and power-reflective kinds of language we have. What's this about? And so it was very exciting because the church folks were rediscovering the power of some of the old language. Let's call each other neighbors, or let's call each other friends, or let's call each other partners, all of the kind of language that has to do with exchange, with two-way streets, with giving and getting at the same time. I think the final thing I want to say about that is it seems to me that there are two things. There are theological ramifications of that. You've got to think about not scarcity but abundance. Begun to figure out ways of acknowledging in very practical terms that everybody in that soup kitchen, whether they were in the kitchen originally or in a line originally, that everybody is a child of God. And what does that mean in practical terms? It means that everybody has fullness and everybody is gifted and everybody's gifts will be given. On the political end of things, I think what they were discovering was a way, if you will, of revitalizing local democratic practice. Talking with John Marty earlier, I'm pretty convinced that that the core of democracy happens in communities. And what happens in local communities is more important than what happens in Washington, D.C. in so many different ways. If local communities remain vital and democratic, if people come out of their door every day recognizing their own capacities, join with each other and try to make that public space called a community better, that's a base that no nefarious policy direction in Washington, D.C. or a state capital can ever destroy. And it's the base out of which democratic vitality will continue to flow. So theologically, politically, it seems to me that community building based on abundance and assets has the promise of beginning to just glimpse a little bit of the beloved community here on Earth. That's all I know, and probably it's time for Vespers. I'd be happy to talk with people about this.